Chapter 11, Pine Mountain, Georgia, 1994 to 1995. Stan had bought a 10-acre lot 5 miles from a resort golf center in Pine Mountain, Georgia, called Callaway Gardens. His idea was to eventually build 8 or 10 log cabins for short-stay tourists. He was also going to build a central cabin as the rental office, restaurant, and welcome center. I was to start my employment by managing the log cabin building crew, and end by managing the corner complex. I told him that when it came to building log cabins, I didn't know my ass from a lodgepole pine. In the meantime, he was building cabins for customers in and around the hills of Pine Mountain. He explained that my actual job would be to oversee the crew, relay messages, and go for lumber, supplies, etc. He wanted someone he could trust to be on the worksite, report on progress, and rat on any of the workers if they goofed off. In short, keep an eye on them, Jim. Tell me what they do. By the time I arrived in Pine Mountain, Stan and the crew were in the process of building 5 cabins in the hills of the surrounding area. After they finished these cabins, work would begin on the corner lot project, the raison d'etre of my employment. I met the crew. The tooth-to-tattoo ratio was acceptable, 2 to 1. Among other things, the crew had experience in working on prison farms, house trailers, community service, and their own homes. Their reading comprehension skills baffle me to this day. They weren't able to read a Dear Abby column, but why would they want to? However, they instantly understood blueprints, zoning laws, and subpoenas. All in all, they were a great group of guys who readily accepted me. While this job lasted 1.5 years, we had a wonderful working relationship. After I had been introduced, Stan left. I confessed to the guys that I didn't know a soffit from a fascia and would never pretend I did. I also offered myself up for any unskilled labor they needed. How could you not like a boss like that? My living arrangements were somewhat unusual. Stan had been divorced and won custody of his 2 boys. This alone made me believe his wife was just as smart as he was. When I showed up, Stan, his 2 sons, Jacob and John, and a large black lab were living in a 4-bedroom log cabin model home. I got the 4th bedroom. Some job descriptions end with, "and other duties as assigned." This generally implies your status as an indentured servant. Jacob was 14 years old and John was 12. They behaved like typical pain-in-the-ass adolescents, a condition exacerbated by their parents' divorce. In short, they felt entitled. There was more to regret. Living with Stan was all the more difficult because Stan, despite or perhaps because of his genius, was a slob. His procreated nuts fell not far from the tree. Thus, my first other duties as assigned, get the house back in order and keep it that way. Although the task was daunting, I am a tidy man, just like the name says. After 1 or 2, the place looked and smelled swell. Keeping that way was just part of my deal. I paid no rent. Jacob took after his dad. He was the genius child. No argument. This kid was brilliant. His head was always buried in a book or a computer. He was so bright that the FBI showed up on Stan's doorstep one day because Jacob had hacked into the Pentagon. He was sarcastic and a little condescending and got along but never really hung out with his younger brother John. Not that this bothered John at all. He was just the opposite. At the time, John was 5 feet tall and growing rapidly. He was the jock, hunter, adventurer, outdoor type who would hold his breath until he passed out or got a new 4-wheeler ATV, whichever came first. The 2 were spoiled and unappreciative, a combination of traits that made me understand why some animals eat their young, or should. For some reason, Stan thought Uncle Jim might be able to talk some sense into them. Just like many people have thought I'd make a great salesman, Stan never specified the type of counseling they needed or what he thought I could provide. He did say on 1 or 2 occasions, "Jim, maybe you talk to them, yes?" Don't forget, I'm the people person, the manager of nitwit retail employees, and the draw-the-line-in-the-sand bus driver. My wisdom and tactics for getting the most out of recalcitrant miscreants were legendary. How tough could it be to guide a couple of typical teenagers back into the fold? I never found out. I couldn't stand being around them. I was no help to them or to Stan. I found myself staying away from home until everyone went to bed. This was one of my periods of alcohol abstinence. But as I look back on it, I think if ever there was a time to pop a cork of a much-deserved bottle or two of Chardonnay. After avoiding everyone for a month or so, I asked Stan if there was some other place I might live. I told him I needed more privacy. I didn't care whether he believed me or not, but I expect he did. He probably wanted the same thing. In the end, he agreed. One of his completed rental unit cabins in the hills had a finished basement. It had a small kitchen with a shower and a kitchen area with a sink and a two-burner stovetop. No oven. Total space was around 150 square feet. There was no furniture. I picked up a single bed, reading chair, lamp, and a microwave oven. Nothing else would fit. The woods were at my back door. Now that I was alone, I was in heaven. In the meantime, the job was going about as expected, at least for me. The crew consisted of four guys. Terry, hair down to his shoulders, was a wiry, hardened journeyman carpenter with the demeanor of a Clint Eastwood character. He was loyal to the death, but if wronged, he wouldn't think twice about drop-kicking you in the spleen and making you do the funky chicken. A great friend, a nasty enemy. Then there was Ken Sr., a good old boy from Georgia. He looked a bit like George Kennedy, only shorter. Quick to smile, he was a good carpenter and a good family man. I enjoyed being around him. He prefaced important questions or insightful observations with a word he fabricated, factibidnit, pronounced just the way it looks. After he said it on five or six occasions, I finally asked him to explain it to me. I was perplexed. Even then, it took more than a few seconds for him to figure out why. Lucky for me, they took my Yankee ignorance in stride. Ken would say, "Factibidnit, we ain't going to get done before sunset." Or, "Factibidnit, that some bitch would have hit you square in the ass if you wasn't looking." So I said, "Ken, what is that little thing you're saying before you make a statement?" "Todeman, what the hell are you trying to ask me?" "You know, factibidnit." "Boy, what are you, stupid? What I'm saying is, the fact of the business is." "Oh, okay, thanks." Instead of greeting each other with something like, "How are you?" they tended to say, "How about it?" I always liked that. "Hey, Todeman, how about it?" Then there was Rudy, another born and bred good old boy. He was as well-meaning and as great a worker as you could find. Although you had to be very specific with the instructions, you could always expect him to get the job done. If anyone ever gave him a hard time about not working fast enough, he would say in a long, drawn-out Georgia brawl, "But I'm doing the best I can." And he was. I came to use that same statement, drawl and all, when someone nailed me for not living up to my expectations. One day, Rudy was pounding out some nails when he let out a scream and a string of obscenities. When we looked at him, he took the hammer he was using and tossed it into the woods. He said, "That's the second goddamn time I hit my thumb with that fucking hammer." Ken was laughing, and Rudy wanted to know what the hell was so funny. Ken said, "That's the same hammer I was using yesterday. I smashed my thumb with it, too. I looked at the hammer, and I could see the head on it was bent, so I threw it in the woods." Rudy said, "Shit, I was out in the woods this morning taking a whiz. When I seen that hammer, I figured, why would anyone throw away a perfectly good hammer?" Right then, Ken walked into the woods, retrieved the hammer, brought it to his sawhorse, and cut the head off, making it permanently useless. I have a photograph of Rudy and Ken holding their thumbs together with matching purple bruised thumbnails. Ken's son also worked on the crew. Junior had just gotten out of state prison. He had done a year for some bonehead stunt like being drunk and disorderly and resisting arrest. Since his dad and Stan were good friends, the junior edition was hired a week after he stepped out of the slammer. Junior was like his dad, quick to smile and a hell of a nice guy. Junior was 20, sinewy, with six-pack abs and tattoos up and down his arms and legs. He wore two small earrings, one in his earlobe and one in his left nipple. And guess what? His dad still loved him and wanted nothing but the best for him. I admired that. I asked Junior about all the tattoos. He said, "Shit, Todeman. Chicks love this shit. I get laid all the time." There was no reason for me not to believe him. He was a pretty good carpenter, fearless on the rafters and roofs, and always worked his ass off. Stan and I rounded out the crew. On a cool, misty morning, in the middle of October, Junior and I showed up first on the job site. It was 50 degrees. The first thing we did was scout around for some kindling so we could get a small fire going. Within a few minutes, we had a nice little pile that would easily have started burning if it had not been so damp. Junior was a smoker, but no matter how long he held his lighter on the little damp sticks of kindling, nothing happened. I looked around for an alternative source of combustion. This is why I was in charge. I'm a problem solver. I found a half-full can of gasoline that we used for our generator. I brought it to our little pile of potential warmth. I splashed it on the kindling. Junior looked at me with awe and understanding. I set the opened can a foot from our little pile. As soon as Junior lit the fire, the combustion made a loud whoosh. The fire, aside from the initial combustion, quickly burned a trail of gas I had dripped on the ground and onto my boots. In an instant, my feet were on fire. I stomped my feet to put the fire out. This was no help because I kept stomping on other little puddles of gas. Although I wanted to save my feet, I had the presence of mind to notice the open can just a foot away from the small blaze. My quick thinking and firefighter training told me I had to get the gas can away from the flames. So naturally, I kicked the can. Unfortunately, since the cap had never been replaced, the can spewed out more fuel, this time onto a pile of fresh building logs that had been lying in front of a half-built log cabin. The fire quickly found this new trail of gas and sped right onto the fresh logs. It was not until this moment that I truly appreciated how combustible gasoline was. The logs started burning. Junior and I looked around frantically for something to squelch the fire. We noticed a water spigot in the middle of the yard. A 2-foot hose was attached to it. Not good. Then we saw a large sand pile. We used the sand to mix the cement for the cinder block foundations. We threw handfuls of sand on the fire. Still not good enough. Junior ran to his truck, grabbed his Playmate cooler, and dumped out his bologna sandwich, moon pie, and RC Cola on the ground. The ultimate sacrifice. He ran to the spigot and started filling his cooler with water. Fortunately, he was able to douse enough water on the logs to put the fire out and keep it from spreading to the rest of the cabin. By the time we had the fire out, the rest of the crew had arrived. When they exhausted themselves from laughing, they cut the burned ends off the logs and tossed them into the back of my truck. The choice was clear. I drove into town, told Stan the story, and showed him the logs. He looked at me intensely. "Okay, Jim, no more fires at job site, yes?" "Yes," I said. Stan arranged a company dinner later that month. During the dinner, I was presented with the burned-out gas can, a child's firefighter helmet, a toy fire extinguisher, and a fire chief's badge, all arranged and glued to a small piece of plywood. Boy, we sure had a good laugh over that. I worked hard while I was in Georgia. Many times I found myself in death-defying situations, in the middle of which I asked myself, "Fact of business, Todeman, what the hell are you doing here?" After a year and a half, Stan came to the same conclusion, but for different reasons. My value as a crew boss was debatable. My effectiveness as a counselor to his boys was certain. I was worthless, inasmuch as I avoided his family as much as I could. Off the job site, I didn't see much of Stan either. We used to be drinking buddies in New Orleans. Here, I was still abstaining. Was that why he fired me? I never knew him. He gave me a small severance check and wished me luck. I never asked him why, and he never volunteered a reason. All he said was, "Things not working out, Jim, okay?"